Okay, hope everybody enjoyed the little break and is enjoying really, it's really a powerful program. I want to thank everybody. And I want to thank Dr. Glatt. You know, it's true. You mentioned last night we met during the SARS epidemic. And I was speaking to the OU. I was at the rabbi of the shul in the OU program, and they said, you need to bring Dr. Glatt. He's like the OU physician expert. This is going back 20 years ago. And then Baruch Hashem, I think you've been to 11 of the 14 conferences, at least maybe 12. So it's really a pleasure to just to say thank you, my Hakaras HaTov, Dr. Glatt, his wife, and really thank you for joining us all these years.
So thank you, Rabbi Toman, and the Rebbetzin always as well, Ilana. It's always a pleasure and honor to be at the Torah in Motion conferences. They're always interesting. They're always fun. One of the best things is to see a lot of my Canadian and other conference friends again. And Baruch Hashem, we're here in person as opposed to seeing little boxes on a television set. So those of you that are regular attendees over here will remember every single word I said about suicide in a shir a number of years ago. So I am using a few of the same slides because the subject that I was asked to speak about today in terms of suicide is a little bit different than the shir that I gave, must have been 7 or 8 years ago here at Torah in Motion on suicide. That's why I entitled this one 5783 Revisited, because I did speak and you need to know a certain foundation about suicide from a halachic point of view. And there'll be a psychologist and a psychiatrist that will be speaking about it more from a medical perspective. And I'll really be speaking about it more from a halachic perspective. And I was asked specifically to address how do we relate to the person who Nebuch has committed suicide in terms of some of the halachic practices that go along with, unfortunately, taking care of a person who's passed away, shiva, tahara, all sorts of related questions that come up. But in order to understand that, you have to know a little bit about suicide itself. So the next slide, please.
Hold on.
Okay, we're good. I'm going to go forward now.
Pointed towards
you?
Yeah, yeah.
No, you have to go back a slide or two. Yeah. Right. Okay. So I'd like to start off with a tshuva from Rav Oshri Zatzal, who was in the Kovno ghetto and paskin some of the most horrific shailas that ever had to be paskin by a person. And he wrote a sefer called Shailos HaTshuvos Mimama Kim. And this is a phenomenal work considering the halachic aspect of it, but it's an even more phenomenal work where you consider the conditions under which it was written, under the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram, killing, torturing, and maiming Jews on a regular basis, and he was asked the most horrific shailas. So the first shaila that we'll deal with was asked in the Kovno ghetto, and he survived the Kovno ghetto, and he went on to be a Rav in the Lower East Side for many years. And this was 2 days before what was called the Black Day of the Kovno ghetto, when Nebuch, a huge portion of Klal Yisrael, was horrifically killed. And the way the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram, would do it, they would often kill the leaders of the community after they destroyed their families in front of them. They wanted everybody to see the leader of the community broken. And that would be their way in which they would subjugate people and make sure that people wouldn't start up with them. And the leader of the community, who knew he was going to die in 2 days, went to ask a shaila from Rav Oshri, is he allowed to commit suicide? He knew he was going to die. He didn't want to die. He knew they were going to murder him. They were going to butcher him, kill him. But they would first kill his family in front of him. And therefore, he didn't think he could take that. And he wanted to kill himself beforehand. So.
Next.
Yes, please. Next slide. So, Rav Oshri Paskin. Go back one slide, please. Rav Oshri Paskin that you're not allowed to commit suicide. One more slide, go back, please. So he Paskin, you're not allowed to commit suicide. The Torah is strongly against a person taking anybody's life, including their own life. And it's a Chilul Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name to go and commit suicide. Now, we're not Chas V'Shalom calling anybody that did commit suicide. Unfortunately, I've had to deal with this as a Rav and a Shul, people that never commit suicide. And that nobody should take anything that I'm saying or that any Rav is saying in any way, in a pejorative way against the person that Nebuch took their own life. And I'll talk about the halacha l'mais ramifications of that statement momentarily. But we have to know what the facts are. You can't confuse emotion and facts. We have tremendous sympathy. We have tremendous empathy. We have to have understanding for what the family is going through. But that doesn't change around the fact that it is absolutely usur to commit suicide and that there are very strong statements in our Masorah against this. And Rav Oshri Paskin that you can't do that, even though it would be a horrific situation to follow. And in fact, he notes that there were in all of Kavanah only three suicides during that entire period of time. And they were all in people that Nebuch were depressed, I think puts it mildly. They were people that were unable to face the torture and the horrible situation that they were in. None of us should ever be in such a situation. And basically, his tshuva said that you have to be a mamin. You have to be a person who trusts in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Next slide, please. And he wrote, he says, Lo hayu begeto kovna mikre ibud ledas. We didn't have in our community, in Kovno, people that committed suicide. And he said, at the end, Kulam heminu bebias ha-Mashiach v'choyom. Unbelievable that in the midst of this horror, we're maminim b'nei maminim. And that's something that we have to remember. That's something that we need to instill in our patients who are suffering from extreme, severe psychological, mental, sometimes medical, besides psychological issues that make them wish that they were dead and make them sometimes act on those impulses and those desires. And we have to understand how difficult it is for them. But we also have to understand that the Torah Kedosha says that that's not an acceptable outcome. And we have to constantly keep this tightrope, if you wish. It's usur, it's usur, it's usur. And then Rachmon Litzlan, if it happens, to not continue saying it's usur, it's usur, it's usur, but to treat that family who's mourning with compassion, with dignity, and to figure out a way how to take care of their current needs, even though somebody has done something that may not have been halakhically sanctioned. Next slide, please. Now, the source for all of this is V'ach es dimchem l'nafshosechem medrosh. So the Medrash Rabbah brings down the extra word V'ach, comes to teach us lohavi es hachonek atzmo. The Medrash Rabbah, Tanoik source, tells us that you're not allowed to go and kill yourself. Shol HaMelech. We know the Shaul HaMelech committed suicide. We know that there are other cases like Hanani, Mishol, and Azariah. So that's coming to teach us, that there are possibly exceptions to some of these situations, but it certainly isn't the accepted psak halacha that you can go and commit suicide. Next slide. And I won't go into this great detail. There are a number of sources over here, and this is really the basis for how do we know that there are different types of ritzicha? We have already discussed at this convention, and we've discussed many times in the past, the euphemisms that we use to somehow make ritzicha, murder, acceptable. We call it euthanasia. Sounds very pleasant. Mercy killings. And we can understand them on one level. We can understand the spouse watching their beloved partner for 60, 70 years suffering with the ravages of a metastatic disease and saying, I don't want to see them like this. Let's put them out of their misery. We understand that. We sympathize with that. We can even daven, according to some, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to stop the suffering for the person. But we're never, ever, ever allowed to actively do something about that, neither for a loved one and certainly not for somebody that you do not love. So Miyad Ha'adab refers to cold-blooded murder. Miyad Ish Achiv refers to mercy and killing, and both are usur. Next slide, please. Okay, so I think we skipped this one, but that's okay. Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, they essentially refused to bow down to an idol. Tosfos brings down that technically they would be allowed to be bowing down to the idol. It wasn't Avodah Zarah, but they felt that they were going to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim and not bow down to this Andarta, which is a bust, which was basically an image of the Caesar, of the king, and they felt that it would be a bigger Kiddush Hashem if they didn't bow down to this, even though it wasn't an Isser of Avodah Zarah. And they basically were willing to give up their lives in order to do so. So how are they allowed to do this? So Gemara brings down, you can go to the next slide, please, that this was an exception to the rule. First of all, they weren't killing themselves. They were allowing themselves to be killed, and they had a hetter to do so. The Gemara goes through other stories, the famous story of Rechinina ben Trajon, one of the Asar Ruge Malchus, who unfortunately was killed for that horrible crime of being a Jew and for the horrible crime of learning Torah. And things, unfortunately, you know, as time goes on, things don't change. There's still Jewish people being persecuted. There's still tremendous anti-Semitism. There still is hatred of Jewish people just because we're Jewish people, not because we've ever done anything to anybody else, and because we want to live our lives in the Torah fashion. And Nebuch, that's a crime in parts of the world for us to do so. And he was killed in a horrific way, and he was able to go and die faster if he would just unravel some of the bonds that they put around him, some of the wool that they put around him. So he says, "Mutav shi'lenu misha notna ve'ayichabel hu bi'atzmo." It's better that HaKadosh Baruch Hu take it than me undo this in any way. And ultimately, he had a guard that was so impressed with him, and the guard said, "If I do this, will I be guaranteed the world to come?" And he said, "Yes." And he was guaranteed, and a bas kol came out. You can't get much better proof than a bas kol, even though we don't paskin like a bas kol. But if a voice from God, from Shemayim, rings out and says, "Rabbi Konani ben Trajon, the Khalid Storni, the guard that was watching him, both of them, is one of him chayalim abad." So under certain circumstances, we are allowed to do certain things that may cause an earlier death. But that should not be confused with, in any way, giving a hetter for suicide. Next slide, please. We have a story, a famous story from Shoftim, where Abimelech would have been killed by a woman, which is a tremendous busha for such a warrior, for such a person. So he asked the person who was assisting him with his armor to go and kill him to be saved from the extreme embarrassment, from the mental stress of having been killed by a woman. So again, that doesn't mean that this is permissible. This is what he did. People sometimes quote these stories and say, "Oh, under duress, a person is allowed to commit suicide." But this isn't brought down as a halachic source. It's brought down as in extenuating circumstances that halacha would not have allowed. Next slide, please. And Shimshon, we know the story of Shimshon. I don't have to tell people the story of Shimshon, but Vayomer Shimshon, at the end, he says, "It's better for me, Tomas Nafshi and Plishtim. It's better for me to go and commit suicide here and take down all the Plishtim enemies, rather than me not doing so and be more trouble for Klal Yisrael." Again, this is not a heter in any way, shape, or form for suicide. And people sometimes bring these stories that I brought down from Shaul, from Abimelech, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah to say in some way suicide is permissible. And the bottom line is these are not brought down the halacha. Next slide. I mentioned about Shaul already. Shaul also, he took his own life, but there are heterim for these, and the post can go through reasons why there are heterim for this. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that now, but basically the next slide will tell you that if there is a threat of you doing Avodah Zarah, next slide please as well. If there's a threat of you doing Avodah Zarah, they're going to torture you, or there's going to be a huge Chilul Hashem. They had paraded Shaul around in a degrading fashion. Under a situation where a person may be forced to be kofar be'ikar. So then there may be heterim for a person to commit suicide under those extremely rare situations. That is not the standard typical case for 99.999% of people that Rahman al-Aslan have attempted suicide or, heaven forbid, have actually committed suicide. Next slide, please. And the Marzab, which is one of the commentators on the Bereishis Rabbah, says that it would have been a huge Chilul Hashem. So if somebody is facing, causing a chilul Hashem, maybe there might be a het of him to take their own life. And the Ramban points out that we see a raya from this in the Gemara that Klai Yisrael was punished, David HaMelech was punished to a certain extent for not giving a proper hesped, a proper eulogy to Shaul, which obviously would not have been indicated. And that's the start, really, of the next part of the talk. Are you allowed to give hespedim? Are you allowed to bury somebody in the normal fashion if they've committed suicide? Next slide, please. So again, here's some more sources. The Daz HaKadim said that he didn't do a sin. Shaul didn't do a sin because, again, it either would have been a chil Hashem or he would have had to go and worship idols. They would have tortured him in some way. So bottom line is that he can't be used as an example for halachos of suicide. Next slide. And we all know, of course, the famous story of Masada, when people chose to kill themselves rather than to fall into the hands of the Roman occupiers, the Roman torturers. So again, halachically, was this something that's permissible or not? So the post can talk about this. Next slide. And the Beis Yosef, who is the main commentator, one of the main commentators on the Torah, Shulchan Aruch in Eridea, tells us a very, very difficult story. There once was a certain Rav who was living in a time like in Masada, where there was tremendous persecution of the Jewish people, and there were taking Jewish babies and raising them as non-Jewish children and forcing them to live a life of Avodah Zarah. And the only option to stop that was never killing those children. And this Rav Paskin, who was a gadol, he Paskin that you're allowed to go and kill those children to prevent them from being kidnapped, stolen, and forever living a life of Avodah Zarah. The other Rabbanim were very angry with him. And the Torah brings down this, and the Beis Yosef in the Torah brings down this story, and he says that this other Rav is doing something that is incorrect, even though his purposes were very noble. To kill somebody, to take a life, is so incorrect that Rav will die a Misa Mishuna, will die an unusual death, and Nebuch, that's what happened. That Rav died a very strange death. Next slide. So what did the Poskim say, Lamaisa? How do we go about dealing with a family that Nebuch has committed suicide? There's a person in the family that's committed suicide. So if that person had a heter, those rare situations where it's permitted to commit suicide, you're afraid they're going to torture you. They're afraid they're going to worship Avodah Zarah. So then there may be heterim, and that person, you give a full Jewish burial to. You give absolutely, there's no concern. You do a full tahara. You do a full Levaya, you do a complete and total Shiva, there's Avelus, everything Kimin Hagenu, like our custom is, you do that. And that's in a situation where it would be halachically allowed. But what happens if it's not halachically allowed? And again, this slide is really a summary slide that you can keep for yourselves. I don't want to go into it in great detail because of time constraints and because I want to focus on what's the halacha l'maisa today. So the Marashah brings down, obviously, it's not permitted to commit suicide, and Shaul was the exception. And the Tuv Tam V'Das, Shlomo Kluger, one of the great Gedolim from the 1800s, said that under certain situations, it might actually be a Kiddush Hashem to commit suicide. But our cases of suicide today, Baruch Hashem, shouldn't ever come to that, are not falling under any of these circumstances. So the classical poskim don't really discuss what do we do with a person who is committing suicide because of mental illness, because of pain and suffering, psychological or actual physical suffering. And how does halacha deal with that? Next slide, please. So here's where I want to focus the last few minutes of my talk. And how do we treat somebody who is ma'aved atzmo ladas, a person who actually goes and commits suicide, kineged halacha? There is no halachic imperative or halachic sanctioning for this person to do what they did. It's not Shaul. It's not Hanani Mishaul and Azariah. It's not a person who's dying in the Kovno ghetto. Talking about a person who never has tzaris. We can't put ourselves into that person's mind, and we don't know how those tzaris are affecting them, but we see the end result. They've slashed their ritz. They've taken an overdose of medication, and they've never killed themselves. How do we treat such a person? what's the Torah's approach to a person who has done an Aveira, clearly done something that is not allowed? How do we view them? So, Adam Eino Shalit Yochid Al Chayav. A person has no control over their lives. This is a huge difference between Judaism and secular authority, secular mores. In the secular world, you are the owner of your body. You and only you make all decisions. As long as you don't do something that harms anybody else, you are free to do whatever you want with your body. Anything you want to do with other people that are consenting, anything that you want to do in the privacy of your home with nobody else there, you have the right to do so. That is the secular viewpoint in a nutshell. Maybe some slight modifications under certain situations. Halacha could not be more diametrically opposed to that. We have halachas about how a person goes to the bathroom. There's nobody there but you and God. We have halachas. We have halachas how you tie your shoes in the morning. We have halachas that tell you how you're supposed to think. We have halachas that tell you how you're supposed to conduct every moment of your life. Because our lives aren't ours. They're very generously given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take care of them in the way that he asks us to do so. And we don't have the freedom of will to do what we want. We have only the obligation to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do with our bodies. So we do not have the right to do with it whatever we want. And therefore, from a pure halachic point of view, Paskin din Shulchan Aruch, as I'll show you in a moment in the Aruch HaShulchan as well, it is also to be ma'aved atzma ladas. It's forbidden for a person to go and kill themselves. And the poskim write this is an isser chomor. They don't write that about everything. You know, there are certain mitzvos, certain asays and los asays that are given stronger power, if you wish, additional strength versus others. The old mitzvos, we can't calculate which one is higher, which one is lower, but the language that's used in certain isurim is strong. And here it says it's an isser chomor. And furthermore, it's brought down in many places, and are codified here by the Aruch HaShulchan. I'll give you the exact address and quote. Yeridei Simin Shin Mem Hei Sif Aleph. He brings down from Mispar Achronim, from the number of the Achronim, Holku Upasku Shiesh L'Misaved Chelik L'Olam Haba. He says that they do have a Chelik in Olam Haba, some. But there is that statement, which I didn't read, and now we're going to read, that says, Ein Lo Chelik L'Olam Haba. So there's a machlokas amongst the great poskim as to what is the status of the eternal life of a person that commits suicide. There is a strong opinion that says that they do not have a chelik, the Olam Haba, which is an extremely strong and harsh punishment. And then there are mispar achronim, there are some achronim that disagree with that. So what's the halacha l'maisa? How are we supposed to view an egregious act, an act that we may somehow comprehend and understand, but certainly can never condone? Next slide, please. So in the era of Abbasi, he brings down, Ama'abidis asmo bidas, ein mis askini mobuchol dover. So he paskins that you're not allowed to go and bury that person in a normal fashion. We don't have a normal kvura. We don't have a shiva. We don't have a velus. But not everybody agrees with that. And I want to just focus, because of limited time, on the statement of Rabbi Akiva, in the third paragraph, if you wish. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Anach lo bistomo, al tevarcheyu v'al tekaleyu. Leave the poor guy alone. We do a partial burial. Ein korin, we don't do rib kriya. The family members don't rib kriya. Ein cholzin, they didn't do other aspects of mourning. They used to have a certain type of toga that they would wear. They would take it off one of their shoulders. They wouldn't do that. They must speed him love. They wouldn't make hespedim. However, Rabbi Akiva says, Abel omdim love bishura. They did have the mourner's row that the mourners would pass through and people would give them nichum. And the armalov birchas aveilim. And they would give them nechama. Why? Because there are two aspects of a funeral. There's the aspect that's done for the departed, and there's an aspect that's done for the remaining, those that are the relatives, the friends, those that are mourning the loss. And he distinguishes between actions that are done for the covered of the mace, the covered of the person who never passed away, versus the covered of those that are still alive. And the Evel Rabasi concludes, Kol shudavar, kol shul covered a chayim, anything that is done for the remaining living relatives, a rabbi was asking about. That we do. But if it's not done, something that's done for the living, but it's done for Nebuch, the person who committed suicide, ain't a rabbi mitzaskimbo. We don't get involved with that. So that's the first breach, if you wish, in this yes or no. We treat them as a zero, or we treat them as a full-fledged member of society that passed away. So here we start to see a dichotomy. Go to the next slide, please. How does Shulchan Aruch pass this? So a lot of these things are controversial. Okay, so Shulchan Aruch says, "Mamaisa b'makom she'enenu yodim vivados shemedubar b'mikro his abdus nohagim dine avelus al hames." So Shulchan Aruch writes that unless we know all the details, unless we have a comprehensive understanding of what went on, there are heterim to allow us to give a complete, quote, Jewish burial. And all the Jewish ceremonies and customs associated with that are allowed to be done unless we know for a fact that this person had committed suicide and was of sound mind, which almost is like a, an impossibility for a person to commit suicide with a sound mind. So that's a extremely important statement. And he adds, "Vishyeshno sofik," when there's any doubt, "imha his abdus nova mitoch matzav nafshi meorer," if there's any doubt that there were extenuating circumstances, mental health issues, afiluzmani, they don't have to be permanent, chronic, they could be temporary, short term, drug induced, something else. "Noagim dini avelus alameis," then regular shiva and avelus takes place. And he says, "Nitan lomar bebirur shirov ha-mis'abdim kalul b'hagdara zu." He can say with certainty that healthy people don't commit suicide. An obvious given, but it needs to be stated halachically that if a person has mental illness, halacha views that no different than it does pancreatic cancer, no different than it views a heart attack. Because we may or may not understand organic basis to disease, that's our problem. That has nothing to do with the person who is sick, the chole or the chola. And they have an illness. And therefore, if they're doing something that is not under their control, so in regards to burial, we have the halachic right to treat them as a person who is not committing suicide, but as a person that died under tragic circumstances. And I'll conclude just with some of the modern-day poskim, and modern-day, I'll call the last couple of hundred years, with some very interesting stories. I didn't have a chance to put them into the slide, so I'll just tell them to you. I think that's my last slide. So about 200 years ago, there's a story about a Jew who Nebuch was in jail someplace for committing murder. Now, the jails in those days were not the same as jails that they are today. The person probably was not fed. The person probably was tortured. The person probably was being abused in many different ways. And that person committed suicide in jail. And the question was raised to the Baruch Tam, or Baruch Frankel, one of the Gedolim. What do we do with this person in terms of sitting Shiva? What do we do with this person in terms of Avelus? What do we do with this person in terms of burial, Kriya, etc.? And the Baruch Tam Paskin, who can judge this person? How do we know what he was going through? How do we know what was going on in this person's mind who was in this horrible situation? And yes, if he'd asked the Shaila, "Am I allowed to commit suicide?" we would have told him no. But he didn't ask a Shaila. And even if he did ask a Shaila, as I'll tell you in another case in a moment, you're entitled to give him a full burial. The family will sit Shiva in that situation. This similar opinion was also Paskin in other situations by the Chidah, one of the great Sfaradi Poskin from the 1800s, and Mordechai Benet, the great Ashkenazi Posek, and they both said that we cannot judge what was going on in that person's mind. And while from external circumstances, it looked like they committed suicide, which they did from an objective point of view, but we can't know what was going on in their minds to say that they were doing this, hinini muchanim mezumin lekayem iser ritzichas atzmi. You know, there's no such nusach. The person says, I hereby know I'm willing and intentionally committing suicide, going against God's will. So since we don't know that they said that, and almost certainly they didn't say that, you're allowed and entitled to treat them with a full Jewish burial. Chassam Sofer, he writes and says that if you find somebody dead in a situation which looks like suicide, you don't assume that it's suicide. They're not called the Ma'avid Atzmo L'das, and he introduces the idea, or he certainly mentions the idea of Kavod HaMishpacha. You can't go and disrespect the family. Ah, look at that family. They had a son that committed suicide. You can't do something like that. There's a certain Kavod HaBrios that we have to have, and that the trappings, the customs of Shiva are very important in the healing process, in the mourning process. I've had many guys tell me after they've gone to pay a Shiva visit at a Jewish person's house, a colleague's house. Sometimes you'll have people from work of different religions going to pay a Shiva call on somebody that passed away, a colleague passed away. And I can't tell you how many times some of them have told me, it's so beautiful. Your Shiva is so beautiful compared to what we do, you know, which in some places is a big party with a lot of booze in the house of the departed. And this is what they've told me. I don't have personal ideas on this. So this is what non-Jewish people have told me about how beautiful our customs are. It's not to say that they may not have beautiful customs. That's not my intention. It's saying that outsiders view our customs of mourning in such a beautiful way. And if one really understands the halachas, when you go to pay a Shiva call, you're supposed to sit there and remember the mace, not talk about people talking, I haven't seen you in 30 years. How you doing? What's going on? You're supposed to talk about the niftar or the nifteris. And it's really beautiful to hear stories. So many people in shivas have told me, wow, I didn't know that about my own father. I didn't know that about my own mother. This person knew them in a different way. And that's the beauty. And when a person commits suicide, that is taken away from them. If we took it away from them, that's going to impair their healing process. And that's the Kavod HaMishpacha. And that's an important point that Chassam Sofer said. The base of Ephraim Margolius, he adds, and he writes that even if it was financial stress, Deborah, how many people committed suicide on Black Friday, and people committed suicide with a depression, you know, they had crushing financial responsibilities, and not that that's an answer, but they took the suicide option as the way to get out of their problem. It's a terrible answer. All of us would agree objectively, don't do that. If they'd ask a Shiloh before, we'd say, don't do that. But they did it. They didn't ask the Shiloh, or they were not in a frame of mind to be able to comprehend the severity and finality of their act. So the Beis Ephraim writes, you give the person a regular burial. Again, who are we to put ourselves in that condition? I want to conclude with a tshuva, actually a shir that I heard from Rav Asher Weiss. Shlita. And he had a terrible story, terrible case, where a person came to him who was in a terrible matzav. I think it was a paraplegic of some sort, terrible pain and suffering. And he wanted to commit suicide with halachic permission. And there was no heter. There just wasn't a heter. It wasn't falling into any of the categories that I mentioned might possibly be a heter. And he wanted to do it kedas v'chedin. And there was no way to do it kedas v'chedin, and the Rav Asher Weiss told him that. And Nebuch, the person, ultimately did commit suicide. And Rav Asher Weiss paskened that one is allowed to be makel to say that the person had charata, that as he was doing whatever he did, you know, the story is a person drowning. He drowned himself. But Mestamba, as they're drowning and gasping for breath, they say, I wish I hadn't done that. There are people that, you know, take an overdose of medications and it has irreversible harm on the liver, right? The Tylenol overdose is one of the most horrible overdoses to have. If it's not recognized and treated early, you're going to die of liver failure. You know, but they're going to die 5 days later of liver failure. They're not going to die right away. And you talk to them on day two, day three, well, you know, I'm really sorry I did that, but now it's irreversible without a liver transplant. So there's a certain charata, I wish I hadn't done that, that one has the halachic right to assume, even after they did their act, you know, they slit their wrists and say, uh-oh, now what? I wish I hadn't done that. If they had even a hearer, even a thought that they didn't want to do that, then they're no longer halachically called. Moshe White says, they're no longer halachically called ma'avid asmol adas. They're not considered halachically as if they committed suicide. Factually, yeah, they killed themselves. But from a halachi point of view, in terms of the nahagas of avelus, of being able to sit a normal shiva for them, to have the family rip kriya, to have a burial, have the normal healing mourning process. So then the post can say that's allowed for COVID mishpacha, for other reasons that I've mentioned, you're allowed to do, he says, a full kvura, avelus, kriya, and COVID ames. And we should never, ever have to be in a situation where we deal with this. But unfortunately, mental illness isn't going away. With all the brand new innovations in the care of people with serious mental illness, they're not perfect, just like they aren't in any other aspect of medicine. We're going to have to be dealing with just shilas. And the important two-pronged message that we always have to teach our children, we have to teach ourselves, we have to teach professionals, is that suicide is not an acceptable halachic or medical outcome. And that we have to do everything to prevent it. We have to do everything possible to ensure they get the appropriate mental health care. That shouldn't be a problem. We have to do everything in our power to teach people that that's not an acceptable halachic alternative in any way, shape, or form, no matter how much you think this, I'm in the worst situation. A person just got terribly embarrassed by something that he did, and he's feeling tremendous busha and shame, and he can't face life. And he said, well, there's an easy way out that window. So we have to make sure that everybody understands that that's zero tolerance in halacha lechatchila. But we also have to have, on the other hand, the understanding that Rahmana Litzlan, after the fact, without compromising for a second, that we shouldn't allow that fact to occur and do everything possible to prevent that. But after the fact, there has to be a certain sense of compassion, love, comfort, and Imo Anochi Betzara, we're with you. The family is mourning. They're not suffering any less. They get zero pleasure out of knowing that, well, you know, he did something that was wrong, and therefore we don't sit Shiva for him. That's not going to help them one iota. And therefore, the great poskim do allow, in most situations, for us to conduct ourselves in the normal way. And Be'ezus Hashem, we should never have to face such a situation, Lamaisa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And okay, Dr. Michelle will, I guess, give some of the medical causes, prevention, what to do. So I said enough.
Great. All right. Thank you. Before I go into the body of my talk, I just want to acknowledge that there are certainly people in the room who've either had a loved one die by suicide or certainly know that. And I do understand the enormous sensitivity of this topic and apologize if this causes you stress, but I do hope that ultimately it is alleviating and widening in terms of awareness and prevention. So I'm going to divide my time into three basic components. The first is going to be just some basic, you know, I don't need the thing at all. There's one slide I wish I had made, but I'll just kind of sketch it out for you. So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes, just some basic information about suicide, stats about suicide. Then I want to talk about prevention. And then I'm going to spend some time, and this really links very much onto what we just heard, onto the aftermath, what happens in the aftermath of a completed suicide, and things to be aware of as community members, as leaders, as educators, etc. So going into that, the basic pointers part, as Rabbi Glatt just mentioned, 90 to 95% of people who die by suicide have a diagnosable psychiatric illness. So the slide that I would have brought, sorry, I didn't do it, is it's a curve, and it kind of goes like that.
and it's very long up here, very long up here, and then it's really a little funnel here. And it's the diagnoses that are connected with suicide. And the very long one is depression. And that is, and it is, and then the little funnel are horrible things. Terrible cancers, Huntington's chorea. I currently am treating a woman, a 52-year-old woman with a diagnosis only a year and a half old of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. This woman is already incredibly compromised, can no longer really function. Her speech is impaired. It's only going to go from bad to worse. There's absolutely no known cure at this point. And she's, I mean, her depression is terrible. And yet she says to me, I don't want to die. I want to live. And I mean, and Huntington's and ALS, which are two truly horrible ones, are in that little sliver. Now, yes, people with those illnesses can have terrible depression. I mean, hopefully I can help this woman with that. I was actually thinking during your talk, this occurred to me for the first time, that I think Shaul HaMelech was depressed. I think that when Shaul went into that, I love the story of the Witch of Endor. And when Shaul HaMelech goes and contacts a witch and revives, so to speak, Shmuel HaNavi, and Shmuel says, sorry, we are finished. I think that is a moment of profound despair. And yes, Shaul can go. I mean, I just thought of this, like, you know, I got working out textually a little bit, but, I think that he is a lost soul. I think he is cycling, spiraling downward into a deep depression. I mean, he wasn't the most stable guy to start with, perhaps. But I just thought of that for the first time. But there is no doubt that depression is the most diagnosable thing to point to in terms of people who commit suicide. Die by suicide. Suicide is, in fact, the 11th leading cause of death in the United States. Now, interestingly, men die by suicide more than 3.5 times more than women. Women, girls, teenage girls, women make more suicide attempts. And that I'm not going to go into today. There's a whole other, you know, psychiatric thing with that. But in terms of death by suicide, it's men. And it's older, single white men who die by suicide more. The loneliness, inability to, it, whatever the cultural aspects are that Black men and Hispanic men, you know, demographically, whatever, correlated for it, don't die by suicide to the same degree. And it's really so striking. In the stats I have from 2021, this is in the U.S., 130 suicides a day, over 48,000 in a year. Now, that still makes it, in terms of a relatively rare event in terms of, like, research. Like, it's very hard to do suicide prevention programs in terms of, like, some people might know the Jed Society. I happen to know somebody who works for the Jed Society, which is an organization that was formed by the father of a young man who died by suicide. And he really has invested a tremendous amount of resources in programs in colleges and other, you know, similar, like, young adult places to try to reduce this terrible thing. It's very, very hard to see results on it because the incidence, although it's terrible, 48,000 deaths a year is terrible, is still not something you can really research easily. I don't know what the gun laws are in Canada. Hopefully they're more civilized than in the United States, where it's just like a bush unbelievably on our country. But firearms account for almost 50% of suicides in the United States. So having a firearm in a home is already like a higher risk thing, and access to something, you know, that is a most often a lethal way of dying. Another main point that I really want to make, and this is a very sophisticated audience, but this point needs to make again and again, and I see you all as ambassadors. I mean, many of you are in medicine, you're physicians, you're nurses, social workers, you are community leaders, you're educators, you're involved in your communities. One of the biggest myths that is perpetuated about suicide is that, if we talk about suicide, it's going to put ideas in people's head. And that is totally not true. There are kind of copycat suicides, but that is different than talking about suicide. In fact, I would say that talking about suicide and talking about depression that might lead to suicide is probably the best prevention that we can do. So So in terms of, and you get this all the time with programs, parent bodies, civic bodies, whatever. If we talk about this, it's going to put dangerous ideas into people's heads. And I think that's totally not the case. I want to emphasize a point that Rabbi Glatt made over, but it has to be made again and again, the impulsivity that goes into, that is fueling many attempts at suicide. Not all, but many suicides are impulsive. One of my students was also in the U.S. Army, and he told me the adage, which I'm sure other people have used, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Most of the issues that people can get worked up at in an impulsive suicide, I'm not saying impulsive like in the last 5 minutes, could be in the last 5 minutes, be in the last hour, the last week, like in a financial crisis or whatever. But people who are like, this is what I got to do. Like they will resolve. They will be self-limiting, romantic breakups, financial loss. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's interesting that 90% of people who survive a suicide attempt do not go on to die of suicide. Now that does mean that 10% do. And there are people who are going to end their lives by suicide no matter what. When I was a resident at Mount Sinai, we had a guy who hung himself in the observation room. Somehow he finagled away out of the cameras. I don't know, whatever it was, but there are people who are, that's, you know, there are people who are going to die by suicide. And that requires a different, I think, level of compassion to the family, et cetera. But I'm not going to go into that, at great depth. So I'm going to move now into the prevention component and recognizing depression. And this is really quite impressive. 14% of people with severe depression do end their lives by suicide. That's a really profound statistic in terms of morbidity and mortality. That depression really can be a lethal illness. People will die of depression. I mean, obviously there's other ways they can die from depression, neglect, getting into dangerous behaviors. But in terms of an intentional act, trying to end their own life, that is, really, really pretty striking. So I think that the most important thing is recognizing depression and not being afraid to ask about it. So when I started the pastoral counseling program at YCT, I tried to speak to people in whatever fledgling or not, mostly non-existent, but whatever anybody was doing, this is back around the 1999 or so. How do you teach? How do you teach clergy to be first responders? And the thing I kept on getting again and again was teach them when to refer. Now, yes, that's true. You need to know how to refer. But before, in addition to needing to know how to refer, you need to know how to be a competent first responder. You need to know what questions to ask, that because you have tremendous power as a Rav, as a teacher, as a nurse, as somebody in the community that people trust, a Kala teacher. Like people go to people that, like there's much more stigma, to use that powerful word, and who's going to make an appointment with a psychiatrist or psychologist and say, I'm feeling suicidal, like they don't know that person before. I don't think too many people. But if somebody sees Joe at Morning Minion or something like that and says, you haven't been here for a while, you're looking a little different. Like, what's going on? I heard something. What's the next thing that rabbi can do, or that caring community person? Somebody notices some despondent mood. Somebody notices a physical change. The person looks less taken care of. They look like something's off. If you pay attention and you ask, you're going to find out. Now, you don't ask the first thing. I never teach first thing. You don't ask this because if you have thoughts about hurting yourself, but that's maybe later down the list. But you do ask, how's your sleep been? How are things? How's your appetite? It looks like you've lost weight. How's your concentration? If you're a psychiatrist or psychologist, you're going to ask about libido, but you're not going to ask about that after Morning Minion, I don't think. But it just putting it in there. So I for completion, but I'm saying the appropriate things, asking about substance use. Have you noticed that you're using anything that you didn't before? Like, what do you mean? Well, like drinking more, maybe using weed, maybe using prescription drugs. Like when you say those words, and I'm using you in the larger plural, not only, I cannot emphasize this enough, not only are you asking for the information, You're conveying to that person that you have heard this before, that it is in the realm of human and Jewish experience, and there's some place to go with it. And I can't say that enough. Like, talking about this stuff brings that person in to the fold of the human community and the Jewish community. When somebody who they identify as a serious Jew, they respect, they take seriously, asks them about that. And then I have my students practice. I have them practice one-on-one. And it's amazing. Each time, each year that I do this, even though they know it's coming, they're so nervous about it. And they have to say, whatever, you know, I don't know, Alan, have you ever felt so bad that you've thought of hurting yourself? And these guys are like sittering away asking that. So then somebody says yes. And then what's the next question? What's the next question? That's right. If you're going to do it, how would you do it? And then Alan says, well, I'm a con. Next question. Yes, bingo. Now, this is not rocket science, but I'm telling you, like someone says, well, I was thinking they don't have a gun. They're not like in the clear. But if they say, well, I was thinking of jumping, then what floor do you live on? I mean, you can always go to the roof. You can always go to the GW bridge. It's not like this is, but the more you ask, the more you're building that bond, that kesher with this person. You're throwing out a life preserver and another one, and you're saying, come back. I've heard this before. We can see you through this. So asking about a history of thoughts of suicide, and also, now, this is like maybe, you know, the advanced level. If somebody got that far, I would be like thrilled. But is there a history of suicide? Have you done this before? Have you thought of this before? So as you're doing this, and I'm using you guys right here, and the people that you talk to about this, you gotta like be like, and checking your own emotional pulse. I mean, like, I seriously mean like checking your pulse, but feeling like, what is your own sense of urgency when you're talking to somebody? Because you've all been, you know, with different people. Like, is something feeling different about somebody? Does the situation feel creepier or more dangerous or whatever? And let's say you're having a conversation with somebody. Why now? What's tipped the balance? You know, is there a loss? And I don't just mean, God forbid, it could be a death, but it could be a loss, as Rabbi Glad referred to, like of some kind of ego function, a job, you know, a status position. Maybe somebody stopped, a loss of something, like even like people in what seems to be in good places, like they were given an honor, they were retired, they were whatever, they seem to be in, but there's like a shift in status. Can be extraordinarily destabilizing. Maybe somebody stopped their medication. Do they have a plan? We talked about that. And have they, another thing that goes along with asking, and this maybe is like the advanced asking, but it's important. Have you made preparations? You know, people might say, yeah, I've left a letter. I've gotten my affairs in order. You know, and then if you can move in, that gives a higher and higher level of a sense of, you know, urgency in making an intervention. Now, I'm not saying you're going to be anybody, you're all going to be doing this when you're asking all of these questions, but when you see somebody who seems to be different, but it's kind of the algorithm of questions. It gets into a more sort of intense and kind of like, I'm taking this seriously. I want to ask you, you can tell me. And as you're thinking about this, assessing the urgency, and you're thinking, well, what am I going to do with this? Because your emotional pulse is racing. You are feeling frightened. You are thinking like, wow, I'm supposed to be going to my squash game. I'm supposed to be going, you know, I have like, I'm teaching a class. I have my chavruta. Like, what do I do with this situation that's on my hands? I've just found something out. Who needs to be involved? Do I need to call 911? You know, and I think you really want to be thinking about like, is there a family member that is, you know, responsible to this human being? Does this person have a therapist? Is there somebody already in the picture, you know, that is emotionally, mental health connected to this? But I remember we were walking out of a movie theater once, and one of my students, former students, actually called me, and he was a congregant. This was an apartment situation, had called him and was talking about suicidal ideation. And he was asking me if he should go up to the guy's apartment. And I said, no, John, don't go up to his apartment, have him come down to the stoop and talk with him, because I don't want him to be alone in a locked apartment in a volatile situation. You know, it just like you want it, you got to think about safety. This is a situation of mental volatility, of, you know, impulsivity, as was said in the earlier session. And I'm saying now, this is a highly destabilized, you know, situation, and you want to think about safety for all people involved. And I have told people who contact me, yes, you walk that person to the hospital. You know, do you drive that person to the hospital? Is that a scary situation? Like, you really got to think about, do you, a very big question is, do I call the police? You know, the person's going to be angry at me. They're going to not trust me. Well, if there's enough sense of urgency, and all of you in the room have been with enough people, you know when something feels like weirdly, scarily in an extreme situation, I'd much rather be safe and apologetic than really, really sorry that I didn't make that call, you know, that I didn't call that. And I'm not saying the mental health system or the police system is at all that perfect or even skilled in this, but you want somebody to be taken to a safe place. And this notion of kind of mental hospital or something, a sanctuary, is the best that we've got at this point. I also want to build on what Rabbi Glatt just said. There is a appropriate, let's say, spiritual, pastoral response in this kind of situation. In addition to, yes, you are still part of the human community. You are still a good Jew, even if you have these thoughts and these impulses. You know, even if you're asking this, I can't believe this guy was asking a halachic shaila, like, can I commit suicide? But no, I want to reel you in. You want to give these messages of hope, of faith, of perseverance. Can even whatever it is, you can't take away somebody's suicidal notion, but you can kind of challenge it. When people say, well, they'll be better off without me, I'm such a burden. These are the kinds of things that you hear, particularly in people who are depressed in very extenuating and extreme medical situations. And the job is to say, you know, I know you, not know you, I mean, know you're not a burden, but like, I know how funny you can be. I know how much good you did in this thing. I know that you deserve, to me, that's a really big operative word. I like the word deserve a lot. You deserve the supportive services. Yes, you're in a wheelchair now, you don't have function, but you deserve, you put so much in to our community and to our society. You deserve to have those services now. It's going to be really hard to learn to live in your mind when you used to be an athlete, but that's something I believe in you, that you could do it. And I think that is like, that's part of what I kept on saying. Yeah, I used the image before of life preservers. There's different kinds of them. There's like the reeling in by acknowledging all the different symptoms and saying, yeah, this has happened before. I mean, you don't say this happened before, but you're conveying that message. And when you ask these questions, you know, about despair and about sleep disturbance and about terrible thoughts and et cetera, you're acknowledging that this is something that happens. But when you say, you know, you contributed this to community. Nobody who is in that dark tunnel of terrible depression can see the light at the end. That is like the worst thing about depression, is that you're just totally in it. You don't remember that you ever did good, that you ever had fun, that you ever laughed. And when somebody else says to you, you know, I know you don't remember that, you can't feel it now, but I remember what you did X, Y, and Z. If you can pull out a memory or you can pull out a thought, that's an amazing thing to be able to do. So I'm going to stop there with this part of it in terms of the most important thing in preventing suicide is picking up on depression and getting somebody connected to some kind of, let's say, you know, temporarily safe sanctuary situation, like not to be left alone. I mean, I remember I had a woman who was postpartum sort of psychosis, and she lived on a high floor. She had a bunch of sisters. They actually built a thing against the door that went out to the balcony. She asked that all the knives be taken out of her kitchen. There was all sorts of reasons why she wasn't going to the hospital, but we really need safety measures. I'm going to move now to the aftermath of a suicide, a completed suicide, because I think that there is, of course, building on what you said in terms of I think the contemporary understanding is that that a suicide was done in the throes of an altered mental state, and the mace and the family deserve the dignity and the support of the conventional, and nobody does death and mourning like we do. I mean, there's a lot of actually psychoanalytic papers on the one called The Holding Function of Shiva that is it's just fantastic. You know, Shiva, Shloshim, all that stuff. It's really brilliant from a psychodynamic point of view. But in the immediate aftermath of suicide, it's quite different from most other deaths. And I think community rabbis know that too. A completed suicide is probably one of the worst experiences a parent and oftentimes a rabbi or a teacher can have. It is a shocking tear in the fabric of life. It's not supposed to happen. I've been able to bring in, usually it's on Zoom these days, former musmachim who have had experiences. I just had a guy who's a teacher in a high school where a student died by suicide, and the impact, on him, on the school was absolutely devastating. And the sense of, like I said, it's like a rip, you know, like it's just so unnatural. And how do you put it together? And the could have, should have, why didn't I see it? Whatever, even if nobody could have done anything, there's still that feeling. And it's so important to establish a kind of neutral, compassionate tone when you're like sort of the top person or the organizing person or the holding person, establishing some kind of forum where people can talk with each other and hear each other and to just allow people to express anger and blame. I had a woman whose husband died by suicide. It was probably in a, it was not financial, it was, whatever it was, some sort of sense of shame in a high professional realm, who died jumping off the George Washington Bridge. And his body wasn't found for several weeks. And it was absolutely terrible because at that point it was quite different than it would have been. And the Chevra was totally freaked out. It was a very difficult situation. And I remember her telling me, and she was pregnant at the time, and she miscarried. So the levels of guilt and relief and anger were, and I remember months later, this was an incredibly resilient human being, the wife, I mean. And she came in and she said she went to her husband's grave and she screamed at him, "If you weren't dead, I would kill you for what you did to me." And we laughed. You know, we actually laughed together, and it was really an incredible moment. I do think, now, when there's a suicide, it's got to be, you know, for educators, rabbis, people in the community, a partnership with the family. Some people want this extremely hush-hush. Got to go with what the family is doing. But some people, and I think more recently, are more open about this. And they do want to address, they want this addressed in some way. They want to address the tragedy of mental anguish. I'm not saying immediately at the funeral, but I do think it's very important. I've seen this a few times. You got to pay special attention at the Shiva house. People hang out in a weird voyeuristic way at houses of Shivas. You see, I'm seeing some heads nodding in a way that's just creepy. And I think you have to, the community has to have like almost like a shomer that sort of moves things along. Help, because a family is, if we feel torn by a suicide, the family is like in rags. And that Shiva house needs to be protected because people ask creepy questions. They hang out too long. Some people come back too many times. It's just a different kind of scene, and that family needs support. In terms of, again, of course, is totally dependent on the family, but they really need to be involved in the funeral itself. You know, to like, they need to be talked about, the typical things that most of us just know about, shoveling dirt, and they sort of need to be talked through that in a different way. And if somebody doesn't want to do it because they're too angry, they're too hurt, they need an exemption. I mean, I leave the halachas and the minhagim up to the rabbis, but all of that has a different feeling for the people who have just lived through a suicide. In terms of helping the community, I was pitching Yimei Iyun before. You do not have a Yom Iyun on suicide 2 months after there was a devastating thing in the community, but you do at some point later on. The whole community, especially if it's a known thing, knows that this happened, and you can have a Yom Iyun. And a person's name would never be mentioned. I mean, sometimes families actually create these in memory of the person. But I do think that it's very important to help a community metabolize the trauma and grow from it in terms of recognition of depression, you know, all the stuff I talked about earlier. And I think that the follow-up with the family, you know, like I tell my students, you got to have, like, they say, well, how do I, you know, how do I remember? You got to get an app or something on your phone. You got to put in, like, in a month, contact so-and-so, not just about, God forbid, death by suicide. But who are the lonely elders that you really want to remember to contact? Maybe you can't do it every week, but if it's an every 2 week Friday afternoon thing, you got to have a tracking system for how you're following up with people, because expecting that you're going to remember this, you know, at the time, of course, it's so wrenching and awful. The people who work in Jewish community, like, another thing comes up, could be a happy thing, whatever, and it moves out of your mind. So tracking this and maintaining follow-up, I'm not saying at all be the shrink to the family. That family deserves mental health support. Hopefully they'll go to maybe a group of survivors of suicide or something like that. But if the role of the rabbi is not to be their psychoanalyst, but it's a profoundly different and equally perhaps more important for some people role, it's being that lamplighter who stays with them over the long haul and checks in and says, how's it going? I was thinking of Yanki the other day. You know, I miss his something or other. Like, using the person's name, that's another thing really, really important, to use to say the person's name so the family doesn't feel like they're in some kind of weird limbo, you know, purgatory, something like that. And of course, I just want to end by saying, you know, paying attention when God forbid it's a young person who's died by suicide, paying attention to the siblings is really critically important, especially if they're kids, because we all know, you know, kids don't, like, they're sad, but then, you know, their fourth grade class comes over for a Shiva call and they're playing ball outside, and that's normal. But paying attention to the siblings and checking and following over time, you know, it's like one of the articles I remember reading from the non-Jewish, the suicide ministry is a very, very long one, but it's a really holy one. And, you know, even though, as Rabbi Glatt ended by saying too, if only we had treatments that work, but I don't think we're ever going to. I think this is part of the human condition, and it's a devastating one, but it's one that we, I think, as a community, as a people, have remarkable resources spiritually, traditionally, and hopefully internally, that we can support each other through. So thank you.
Thank you. It's hard to say I enjoyed these talks, but really they're powerful and moving and inspiring. Really, thank you both. And Achron Chaviva, Debbie Vakasha, going to talk an impact on families, I believe.
I'm thinking I should make this just 5 minutes, because 1 o'clock is, you know, 1:30 is lunch, and I definitely don't want to go over that, because then everybody will hate me and I won't like that. So I'm going to go in a little bit of a different direction. I'm going to talk about mental health and families. I do want to first thank Dr. Glatt and Dr. Friedman. I cannot tell you how important that topic is in the community. Unfortunately, I know of at least 4 people, young people, committed suicide this year alone in our community, and there are more. And every single word they said is true. It is an absolute ridiculous devastation that is horrible, just horrible. And the amount of guilt that the families are left with is not good. So I'm going to do a little bit about mental health and families. And because I'm kind of doing a lot of addiction talk and addiction work, I am going to talk about addiction and families also. It's kind of like my thing. So the objectives here is to understand the prevalence of mental health issues that we have, to really understand what is a family and why it makes it unique, and then the intersection of mental health and family in the Orthodox Jewish community as it revolves around addiction. So we know from statistics in 2023 from the National Institute of Mental Health, and here's just some numbers for you, 19.86% of adults have mental illness in the United States. Lifetime prevalence of anxiety disorder is 31.6%. Percentage of adults with substance use disorder the past year is 7.74%. Bipolar, 1.8%. Major depression, 8.4%. Suicidal thoughts, 4.58%. OCD affects 2.5 million adults, or 1.2% of the U.S. population. So we have the numbers. At any given time, they say about 1 out of 4 individuals will be having some type of mental health issue. 25% equals a lot of people. So what is a family? Let's talk about what a family is. There was a very wonderful author. I don't know if any of you ever read her stuff, Irma Bombeck. She was quite a wonderful comedic writer about suburban life in like the 1970s with three kids. She actually got very prolific and poignant when she was dying, and her stuff was incredible. Anyway, so she wrote a book that was called Family Ties That Bind and Gag. So her stuff was great. So what is a family? So a family is a unit, but there is something really unique about a family that we don't see in any other group. And can anybody just kind of take a guess? Don't say the fighting. Other people fight also. No. What is unique about a family is that it binds us together in all three time frames. Your family represents your past, your family represents your present, and your family represents your future. And that is something that we see only in a family system. That's a very interesting thing, and I find that that's very unique. Our families are changing in our community. My attraction to social work, quite honestly, was the relationship between social work and economics. We are very big into the economic impact on mental health. And that was something that resonated with me very much when I was applying to social work school. So our financial demands are increasing all the time. For example, in Rockland County, the average home price is $600,000, up 7%. Boca, the average home price is $500,000, up 8%. Lakewood.
That would be you. Wow.
Boca Raton, Florida. Boca.
Hello.
Florida. Hello. That's an average home. That's not, you know, that could just be your average house. Lakewood, the average home is $550,000, up 14%. USDA saw an average of $1,500 per grocery bill for a 4-person family. That would be 2 parents and 2 kids. How many religious families do you know that have more than that, that they are spending for? And that is without kosher food prices. No, this comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. When you add yeshiva cost tuitions to that, there is a huge financial burden that is placed on families today. Families are changing shape also in terms of the workforce. 46.6% of the workforce is now female. Yitzi Schachter, who is a director for a Center of Applied Psychology at the Beit Cholim in Muncie, conducted a study on divorce rates in American Orthodox population in 2017. His findings revealed that the Orthodox Jewish divorce rate was hovering at about 10%. There are other studies that will tell you it's higher, approaching over 20%, but we'll go with that. According to Dr. Schachter, why Orthodox Jews are getting divorced. Verbal or emotional abuse, 28%. Feeling put down or demeaned, 50%. Problems communicating, 48%. Unmet emotional needs, 65%. Sexual issues, 62%. Mental illness, 60%. Religious differences, 33%. Undisclosed information, financial difficulties, 30%. And different life goals, 30%. Just parenthetically, and to say something very unpopular, I am not somebody who believes that just because you're married to somebody who has a disease of addiction, you need to get divorced. Quite frankly, I think if everybody who was married to somebody with a disease of addiction got divorced, very few people are going to be married. So I work very hard to try to save those marriages and have people protect themselves and understand how one can live with somebody who has an active disease of addiction, and it can be done. Family work is what we call systems work. And we know that this comes to us originally from a biologist, from the Austrian biologist Ludwig von Bethlehem in 1940s, how he described the universal theory of living. And a system is, quote, any entity maintained in the mutual interaction of its parts. So why we talk about this is because when one thing happens in one part of the family, it filters down into every other part of the family. And that could be if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Father gets a new job and there's a tremendous amount of increase in money, but the family moves, the family will be affected. A new baby comes into the house. You will always see how people get affected. My daughter, who lives in Lakewood, has a house, thank God, has a large family, and she just had her first boy after 7 girls. So this is like a really majorly big thing. And her toddler, she tells me, the baby's a year now, leans down in front of the baby every day and says, you are an ewy baby. I don't like you. And then pushes him down. I'm like, great. She's not going to need any therapy. She's very expressive. That's wonderful. So toddlers do not like when you bring a new baby into the house because they kind of feel that it's as if your husband comes to you and says, you know, I love you so, 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 so much. You're the best thing that ever happened to me. So I'm going to bring another wife into the house also because I love you so much. They don't like it. The child before that, when she had another little girl, the toddler above her would go over to my daughter and pull on her skirt and say, when is the mommy coming to pick up this baby? And the daughter was like, this is our baby. And my granddaughter would get hysterical and say, no, no, we're just the babysitter. Call the mommy, call the mommy. And my daughter's like, yeah, this one's staying. So that can be a major change. And working with families, you know, children will regress. They'll start to wet the bed, suck their thumb, act out in school. And all this just really means that we know that whatever happens in one part of the family is always going to filter down to every other part of the family. Okay. Families work by several different commonalities. Every family has their own set of rules. And in addiction, that rule is don't talk about it. This just stays with us and do not speak. Families have narratives. They have stories that they desperately want to create and stick to no matter what. I was working with a 17-year-old Hasidish girl from the stronger Hasidises, and she was cutting, and it really wasn't good, and it was during COVID. It was very difficult to deal with somebody who's cutting in general, but over COVID, it was really hard. And she would go into her family's van to have the sessions because she didn't trust anything at home, and it's dark, and I'm trying to see what the cuts look like, and it was pretty funky. Now, her mother really was trying, and she did remove all the knives from the kitchen and put them away, and she was trying in that way. And then one night the girl said to me, I know where the screwdrivers are. God, no, please no. So I called the mother and I said, you either have to contract with me and partner with me and make sure this girl is okay, sleep in her bedroom with her, keep the door unlocked. She can't go to the bathroom with the door locked, everything, or I'm going to call an ambulance and she has to go inpatient. Screwdriver is dangerous. The mother said, okay, 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 no problem. She said, but could you work with her on something? I said, what? She said, she's wearing leggings. I'm like, yeah. Like, she can't wear leggings. She goes to the store in leggings. I said, okay. She said, no, that can't happen. And she wears a t-shirt that says, I'm with crazy. She cannot do that. I said, okay, but would you please just make sure that you sleep in her room tonight and we can talk about the leggings, like when she lives, like this is okay, right? And she's like, okay, okay, but very upset with me, dropped me as a therapist because I wouldn't address the fact that her daughter wore leggings. I said, I'm just not going to deal with that. So narratives are incredibly important for families. Boundaries is another concept that we talk about when we talk about families. Some homes have what we call extremely rigid boundaries, and that will lead to something we call disengagement. Family members will feel very isolated. They may be independent, but they lack affection. Enmeshed systems do offer a lot of closeness and support, but it is at the expense of independent competence. Enmeshed parents are way too involved with their parents. I think the term we use today is helicopter parents. They just kind of do too much. I have 11 children, and I definitely distinctly remember my youngest one. I came down to the kitchen one morning. I think he was just over 3, and I was in the doorway, and I started watching him, and he took a chair and he dragged it over to the counter and took some bread and cream cheese, was kind of like smearing his own sandwich. I'm like, look at that. He knows if he doesn't feed himself, it's over. But he definitely had this ability as the youngest to kind of be like, I need to get food. Boundaries are a two-way street, and boundaries with one family member are going to be directly related with boundaries with another family member. For example, the more enmeshed the mother is with her children, the more distance she's going to be from her husband. So again, you see how one part of that family is going to go into all of them. So let's turn now to addiction and codependence. My last talk, we talked about addiction, a chronic pervasive disease that's marked by relapse and recovery that creates long-lasting changes in the brain. It's a mental illness caused by use and misuse of a substance and the integration of trauma. Whenever you have addiction in a family, you're going to have codependency, or what we call co-addiction. That can be with the partner or with the family members. but we'll kind of focus today on the partner of the person that has addiction. What is codependency? Well, it's a learned behavior, usually in children that are growing up in a dysfunctional family, and they imitate their family members that are codependent. The history of codependence, or the treatment for codependency, began in treatment centers for alcoholics, and it was met with a lot of speculation. But the pioneers of codependent research, they started to notice very typical behavior patterns that all families that were working with alcoholics had. And so they started to work with the families also. Today, we have a lot of knowledge of what codependency is and how it affects family systems and the codependent. And so for every 12-step program that we have, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a 12-step program for family members called Al-Anon. Narcotics Anonymous has Naranon. Gamblers Anonymous has Gammonon. Sex Addicts Anonymous has Essanon. And these are, again, free, peer-supported 12-step groups that we very much encourage the family members to go to. It is also based on a 12-step program, and it works marvelously. When I do have a couple where one person has active addiction, I always tell the partner, you go to a 12-step meeting, get into recovery, and things are going to change, and they do. So codependency is a little difficult to define. It's a complex and difficult disease, but here's kind of a one-sentence definition. A codependent individual is somebody who lets another person's behavior affect him or her and is obsessed with controlling the other person. Here are the signs and symptoms of codependency. Now, I gave this talk last September, and I read off the signs and symptoms, and from the back of the room, a voice came out and said, oh, no. So if you feel that that's you, that's okay. It's all safe here. We're all together. Even though we're being recorded, that won't go anywhere. So what are the signs and symptoms of codependency? Well, you feel responsible for others. You get angry when other people do not do what you want. You say yes when you really want to say no. You feel safe only when you're giving to other people. You feel very guilty when people give things to you. You're attracted to needy people. Love that one. The rescuers of the world. Yes, I'm a social worker. However, codependent people make wonderful employees. So if you're looking to hire somebody, ask them if they're codependent and then go for it, because we never quit. You know, we just like hang on and hang on and hang on. People that have addiction will always match up with people that have codependency or co-addiction. It's like a moth to a flame. And I have worked with Hasidic couples who literally have sat across from each other at a table with a plate of rugelach in front of them, have met for 5 minutes. One has addiction, one has codependency. It is truly an act of God. I mean, it can't happen any other way. The person with the addiction is addicted to the substance or the behavior. And the codependent is addicted to the addict. Much like the person with the addiction tries desperately to control their addiction, the codependent or the co-addict tries desperately to control the addict. They are the ones that are running around the house, finding the alcohol bottles and pouring it down the sink. They are the ones going through their partner's clothing and trying to find pills and flush them down the toilet. They are the ones taking their partner's phones and scrolling through it to see who they've contacted or what sites they've been on. And this doesn't just go with substances. I worked with a woman whose husband was a food addict. Okay, he's a food addict. Like, what's the big deal? No, it's a big deal. Because as we talked about in the last talk, addiction is a way of thinking, not doing. This man weighed about 400 pounds. He was big. Weighing 400 pounds, it's very difficult to keep clean. Your skin gets infected. He was repeatedly in the hospital for cellulitis. He just wasn't doing well. So she's a good wife. She's going to take care of this. And she went through the house one day, the entire house, and threw out every package of cheese whizzies and ding-dongs and whatever he had, cleared out the whole place, scrubbed down the cabinets, went shopping, bought fish and chicken and broccoli and brown rice, loaded the house down with all these healthy options, made him a very healthy dinner. He came home, she served him dinner, cleaned up. Well, she's exhausted. She went right upstairs to bed. As soon as, thank you, Michelle and I did not rehearse this talk. As soon as her head hit the pillow, he went to the nearest 7-Eleven and loaded his car down with cheese fizzies and ring-ding doodles and soda and whatever else it was. What should she have done? What she should have done is go to the movies or go get a massage or go out with friends or take care of herself. Because when we talk about codependency and people with addiction, we give them the three C's. And here I'm talking to the ladies. When you date somebody or get married, you want to talk about the four C's, cut, color, carrot, and what's the other one? Quality? I forgot the word. What is that? Wait, cut, carrot, color, and clarity. Yeah, definitely want the four C's. That's an important one. But if you end up being married to somebody who has addiction, you want the three C's. And that's as important, if not more important, than the four C's. You didn't cause this. You will not cure it. And you sure as hell are not going to control it. Back off. It is not up to you to control. Now, this sounds very simplistic, but it's not. I work with very many partners of people with addiction, codependents. There was a woman who I worked with for about 3 years. She was married to somebody who had polysubstance disease. And I got him to go to rehab. He really looked incredibly horrible. He was emaciated. All his teeth were falling out. He was really wasted. He wasn't doing well. And he ended up going to rehab for 6 months. She did great. She really blossomed. She really managed. She was working. She started to take care of herself, go to the beach, go with friends. She really did okay. And then he came back. And she fell apart. I said, well, what do you think? And she said, my husband says. I'm like, okay, but what do you feel? She said, well, my husband said. Well, what do you want to do? Well, my husband said. I said, I'll tell you what. Put a rubber band around your wrist. And every time I ask you that question and you say, my husband, just snap it. What do you think? What do you feel? What do you want? So in an incredibly, like, passive way, she wouldn't let him unpack his clothes. So he lived out of a suitcase for about 6 months. He's back in the house and she relapsed. She is doing really badly. A very wise friend of mine once said to me, addiction will kill the addict, but codependency will kill the codependent as well. And it's true. The stigma in our community very much affects codependent family members. I recently had a young man. I got him when he had overdosed and he was on a ventilator for a week, and somebody asked if I would see him. I said, okay. And we were doing some good work. He was getting a little bit sober, more in a harm reduction way. He was kind of lessening his drug use. And then he kind of just dropped out of treatment, and that was it. Well, his parents called me a few weeks ago, pretty desperate. He had taken ketamine. He fell asleep in the bathtub, and only because his housekeeper like banged on his apartment door and aroused him that he didn't die. And they said, will you see him? And I said, no, he needs inpatient. I'm not, that's right. Like two times in a few months. And I can't do that. He needs a higher level of care. So the father said to me, he's like, well, he needs a Jewish program. It's got to be a Jewish program. I said, well, I can refer you to a Jewish program, but I really think that the way they handle this at this program is going to be a better fit for your son. He said, well, I want him at a Jewish program. What about the socialization aspect? Like, what if people found out? And I said to the father, we're not talking about the senior prom here. We're talking about saving your son's life. And this is the most important thing. They were consumed with what they're going to tell their family members and their neighbors. What will I tell the neighbors? My female client in Muncie, where I told her to snap the rubber bands, I said, do you love your husband? She's like, not anymore. Is he doing anything for this relationship that you like? No. Why are you here? I'm afraid of what my neighbors will say. I said, I don't think they care. I mean, I really don't think they care that much. She said, no, but they're going to talk about me and I won't have someone to walk home from Shoal with. I said, and is that enough to keep you in this relationship? She said, yeah, it is. It's just sad. I want to end with one very extreme story, but one that I do see. There was a family that I worked with, and the girl had a lot of mental health issues, and she had been in rehab for about a year. She had substance abuse issues. She was cutting. And then in rehab, she decided that she wanted to transgender. She wanted to become a boy. So she cut her hair and started to wear boys' clothes. And they released her from the rehab. According to them, she had met criteria and she met outcomes, and she was coming home. Her mother was hysterical. And we had a family session, and her mother was screaming over and over and over again, "I just wish you died. Could you please just die?" And I said to the mother, I said, "You know, you might want to think about that. You just might want to think about what you're saying." And her mother's like, "How is she going to walk down the street looking like that? What's going to happen?" And I said, "And for that, you want her to die?" She said, "Yeah, she needs to die." Well, the girl bolted out of my office, ran down the street. Her father ran after her. I was left with the mother. I said, "I get you're really upset, and I understand you don't want your daughter, you know, to go from being Shandel to Sammy. I understand that. But you want her to die?" She wouldn't back down. She's like, "Yeah, she needs to die." In the 12-step movement, there is a serenity prayer that is said before and after each meeting. And it kind of goes like this: "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." In codependent meetings, or what we call CODA, CODA.org for 12-step meetings for codependents, there is also a serenity prayer, and it goes like this: "God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the people I can, and the wisdom to know that that is only me." We are not responsible for our partner's behaviors. We raise our children, we give them everything that they want, but then we are not responsible for what happens. The only people that we can change are ourselves. And I don't know about you, but that's going to take me about 120 years. So if you have a way to do it a little bit of a faster track, I'm here to listen. Thank you all very much for coming. Go to lunch. I met my time quota. Oh, then wait. No, kidding.
Okay, if they want to come up, take a seat here. Any questions, Rakesha, at the microphone? And Rakesha. Okay. Speechless. We're speechless. Don't know what to say. At the mic, right here, right in front. Oh, right here. Thank you. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'll move the mic. Yeah, yeah.
That is awesome. Thank you very much. Awesome. I got off on your next screen. Has one life. To me, that was the most awesome. Is there a chance to talk to the interview? No.
You're a Gentile here.
I'll talk loudly. First of all, thank you that the talks were fabulous. Regarding the codependence, because, you know, I guess as doctors, we all see this. But what are we supposed to do, let's say, if the kid at home is cutting in front of the mother? Now, what is she supposed to do? Is she to go to a movie? She should go for a massage? You know, I mean, I know you can mean it under those circumstances, but is there any health behavior the mother can do when a kid is really doing something so destructive and you love the kid so much? So what is that mother supposed to do?
I actually did mean it in that way. I mean, if your child is going to harm themselves physically, or God forbid, get into some serious physical, you call an ambulance, you get your child to the hospital, 100%. But that's not really, if that's the case, obviously stop, drop, and roll. Your child needs help, and they go into a hospital. Aside from that, children who act out, and yeah, we do counsel people like this, and we kind of call it paradoxical parenting or counseling. Take care of yourself. Take care of yourself. Mental illness and addiction is a marathon, not a sprint. And you're going to be in it for years and years and years. You go down with the ship, it's over. And the person's not going to necessarily get better. They'll probably get worse. One of the parenting groups that I run weekly, there is a woman who sends a horrible heroin addict. And she hasn't seen him in 3 years. She has no idea where he is. He's on the street somewhere. And she's been in our group for 3 years. And for about a year and a half, she'd come on and just cry and cry and cry. She literally has no idea where her son is. Every once in a while, she'll get a sighting of him. He's working at a restaurant. He was seen panhandling, like somebody saw him and calls her. Really devastating. And after a year and a half of being in the group, she came on the group. She's like, I booked a cruise. I joined a singing group. Her son's going to be a heroin addict until he wants to get some help, whether she goes to a singing group or a cruise. But she's not going to go down with him. So it is imperative, just like when you go on a plane, and if the oxygen has to come down and you're holding a child, you put the mask on who first? On yourself. Because if you can't breathe, you can't save someone else. If your tank is on empty and you're sucking on the fumes and just trying to make it, you can't be helpful or present to anybody. So yeah, I did kind of mean it that way.
I have to say a few words about the wear and tear that I've seen on rabbis, and perhaps you might speak to this as well. When they see, like a rabbi might be involved, let's say, in a codependent situation or a domestic violence thing, and the rabbi gets all worked up and caring and wants to make an intervention, but the codependent person is not ready at that point for the intervention. And unlike the shrink where they make the appointment and they pay the bill and they're gone, the rabbi can see this go on for weeks or months and years. And it's very painful. I think it's really incredibly demanding and draining to see, let's say, this spouse come in and to see the telltale signs of whatever the bad situation is, and to maintain a sense of belief that you're worthy as a rabbi, that you want to stay invested in this person. It's very hard to sustain the long haul. And I believe that are helping people who are not, let's say, the immediate emergency person, let's say the rabbi, whatever, they also need support themselves. And I've been a big fan. I mean, like I always say this when I do these like master classes with the clergy. I really believe in clergy support groups where rabbis, actually could be people of any faith, get together and share really challenging cases and can support each other and offer resilience and strategies for just sort of having to hold on, keep the faith for years until maybe the codependent person or the other person, whatever, can make change.
Any other questions? I'm sorry.
She invited me up, so I'll point that out. How true that is. So I'll just comment how important that statement that Dr. Freeman made was in terms of I get these questions all the time from rabbis from a medical point of view, not so much from the mental health point of views. And I tell all my rabbi friends, and I think this is critical, they need to have their own support system and they need to have their own professionals. Because you went and got smicha and are expert in that area of Jewish religion, didn't also get you a psychoanalytic degree, and it didn't also make you a doctor, and it didn't also make you a social worker, and it also didn't make you every other thing that is expected from the community rav. And the community rav, in my opinion, is probably the toughest job that there exists, because they have to be an expert in every single field 24/7. They don't get off Shabbos. When I became a community rav, it's the first time in my life I worked on Shabbos. I never worked as a doctor on Shabbos. Community rav, you work on Shabbos. And it's critical that they have professionals that can help assist them, not for their own personal, but how do I deal with this? When you have an extremely difficult patient and they're not their psychiatrist, they're not their clinical person, but they're functioning in that role, they're not qualified. But they're there as a listening ear, and they're there to help guide that patient to get to the right people. The rabbi sometimes doesn't know who the right person is. That's why community organizations, community physicians, community psychiatrists, community social workers can be an extremely necessary resource for the rabbi to have. And community-based organizations
are, you know, I just was in a meeting with a bunch of rabbis where we actually had that type of a conversation. We brought in four community organizations to give rabbis resources for that particular thing that those four different community organizations could do to inform us how we could access those resources for our Balabat. So I think that's an extremely important thing, and it's being recognized more now. It was certainly not recognized in the shtetl.
Dr. Sherman.
Why don't we, hello?
It's going into the recording, it's not going to be the mics.
Okay. Why don't we define rabbis and other people in the helping professions as codependent?
I think one of the, you talked about stigma. The two of you earlier also, as a parent with the child who's got addiction, and I'm learning about my role, and it was very hard to find a group, because you feel, you talk about stigma, but there's also, until you find a group to support you, it's sort of weird. And one of the problems I find, at least in the Jewish community, is how difficult it is to navigate your way around to find those kinds of supports. Like I didn't know, for example, what I bring to the table in my child's struggle. And I'm just wondering if either of you two could comment, and you as well. I heard them the last time too. If you can comment about if you see any progress in those kinds of supports being out there for parents. Thank you.
First of all, just to touch on the last person's comment, people in the helping profession can be codependent, but at least we know it. And we try to talk about our self-care seriously. And we always talk to our students in social work school really about self-care, because you can burn out really quickly if you let your own needs fall. Then you can't be there for yourself or your clients. Just a quick example, if you ever get irritated with your client, that's on you. It means you're not taking care of yourself. Your clients should never irritate you. If you're happy that they cancel, you're not taking enough care of yourself, and that's on you. And we have a responsibility to take care of ourselves so we can show up and be the best people that we can be. That's just kind of a, regarding the family and addiction, I agree with you that family members in the Jewish community suffer greatly because of the stigma and the fear. There are programs that are happening. For example, there's a wonderful, wonderful program called TLR, which stands for the living room. And it's getting a lot of attention now because they're using what's called the clubhouse model. And there's a lot of government funding coming in for it as well. Basically, it's a support group for people that are 18 to 35, which includes married people with families. They get together in a meeting, in a 12-step meeting style way, and they have food and they have socialization, and they really make it fun for people to go to. So that's, and there are partners, spouses and families that are going. It started out in Brooklyn. Now they're in Toms River, Brooklyn, Rockland County, and Boca. So they're and five towns. They're really growing exponentially. I was very fortunate to go to their last Shabbaton, their retreat, probably like one of the best weekends I've ever had. I work addiction every day, but going to that recovery weekend, it was just like sinking into warm water. You have no idea the love and the support and the incredible feeling that comes to that. There are groups springing up. There's a group in Teaneck, New Jersey, community group for education on addiction, also for family members. And so the tide is turning. Are we there? No. But there's 12-step program all over the world for family members. And this is kind of one of the things that we need to do is understand that when it comes to spirituality and recovery, it doesn't have to be Jewish. 12 steps is based on the Torah. There's nothing in the 12-step movement that does not agree with our philosophy. Nothing. And so go to a general meeting. You will meet some of the most spiritual, supportive, wonderful people. Get a sponsor. They don't have to be Jewish. They're respectful. They will work you through, like you said, your part. What do you do? Our participant is really bringing up a great point. It's very difficult when you have addiction in your family to be told, so what did you do? That is really very jarring and feels very horrible and really makes you want to hit somebody because you have been suffering along with the person who has the addiction. But that's the beauty of recovery and program. You really do learn in a very supportive, non-judgmental way what you do bring to the table and how you can recover for yourself. So whatever the addiction is that you're dealing with, I just urge you to go to a 12-step program. There's tons of meetings in person, and COVID, one of the blessings of COVID is now there's online and Zoom meetings and phone meetings 24/7. If you're looking, let's say, for AA, there's actually an app for AA meetings, which is incredible, and it will list meetings across the United States and I think internationally. You just plug in your zip code and they pop up all the meetings that are within your vicinity. If you want to contact me privately, I'll try to direct you to some resources.
I'm just going to say, to follow up on that point that was just made, that outside of the New York area, like in the New York area, there's everything for Jewish people. Outside of the New York area, most of these programs take places in churches. And maybe if you can make the resources available, not everybody has access to them.
When they take place in churches, you're the rabbi, don't care, Kevin.
I'm not saying you can't go.
They take place in church basements or the social hall.
Yeah, yeah.
There are many rabbanim, say something, that will tell you that no, it's yeah. not, you're not going into the sanctuary. Yeah. You're going into.
I'm not saying that every rabbi I've ever spoken to,
and you're right, Jewish meetings are different. There are ones in Rockland County now that have been taken over, and Thursday night they're having Chalant and Kugel and Kishna. And to be perfectly honest, I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's great that they can get together as a culture and as a faith and make it very palatable for people to come in, but recovery is a lifestyle.
Yeah. And listen, I totally agree with you. And it's not a halachic thing. And sometimes if you're worried about stigma, it's better to go out of your community. Yeah. But just for people who are taught their whole lives, we can't go into church to go as a first step into church for healing is not so easy.
Tremendous amount of rabbis that I have asked, and you tell them there's nothing that has to do with the sanctuary. There's no religious symbols or anything.
Those caveats, there's no halachic problem going into the church's non-church sanctuary areas. I've had the irony, if you wish, of working for the Brooklyn Diocese, the New York City Archdiocese, and the Rockville Center Diocese. And every one of them involved in some way, shape, or form having to interact with the clergy of those three separate dioceses. And I asked many shilas to break the dole about this. And never did I ever enter into their sanctuary to in any way pray or participate in any of their religious affairs. But when they would have a dinner or when they would have a hospital function that was on their campus, but not in their sanctuary, Sakyas, it's absolutely okay to go. And I would dare say that was for parnasa purposes. Allah has chav v'kamo, it's bikuach l'fashos. So we do have the din of Abisrayu, which means that you can't go even participate for something that wouldn't be outright avodah zarah, but would be what's called an abisrayu, like a tolda, or like a subsection of avodah zarah. But this doesn't constitute that. That's the only place where you can have the appropriate pikuach nefashos care. So then halachically, it's zero problem.
I work for Catholic Charities also.
Okay, it's 1:30, and lunch is next door. Our next session, we're having at 2:30, back here on the live information, so we've got an hour or so for lunch. Enjoy. Okay. Thank you very much.